Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, for our first meeting of the newly constituted Audit and Accounts Committee for this session of the Stafford Borough Council. As you've probably gathered, it's actually quite a heavyweight meeting because you're looking at the internal review for the last 12 months. Having not seen all of it, but you will have now had the summary, and you've also got the internal audit charter to look at, and we have to sign off the annual governance statement that all has been done properly, even though we haven't all got the experience of the last 12 months. Fortunately, we do have the old chairman, who was here for the last 12 months. So we can rely on her expertise to help us through where we have any issues. So, shall we start on the minutes of the meeting 21st of March, as circulated and published?
Approved, Mr. Chairman.
Has anyone got any objections?
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Chairman. Apologies?
Yes, Chairman. Apologies received tonight from Councillor Philip Leeson, who's not appointed a substitute.
Thank you. Officers' reports. First item on the agenda is the internal audit annual report.
Okay, thank you, Chair. I'm going to take this one. So this is the annual report, which is a summary of the work that was carried out in the 2022-23 year, which was up to the 31st of March. I don't tend to dwell on the covering report for these because the detail is all in the summary of the report. But before I go on to the actual annual report, there is Appendix 1, which I would like to take members through, which is a summary of significant findings for the audits that were completed in quarter 4. So essentially these are audit reports which the committee hasn't seen before. Everything else contained in the annual report will have been before the committee. So this is the information since our last progress report. Just really draw members' attention to a few key elements, and that really is the first couple of audits that we've highlighted on page 6 and 7 of the agenda, and that is building control and street scene. These are two audits that we've given partial assurance to when we've carried out the internal audit reviews. For building control, there were a few areas around the weaknesses that we found around the payment procedures and the completion of documentation and some elements around the tendering about the procurement of a contractor who was used regularly without recent market testing. There was also an issue around the trading accounts that have to be produced for building control not having been completed. As I say, those are set out there. And for street scene, again, the issues we identified were around a lack of documented work programmes, an over-reliance on overtime to run the service due to a lack of overview of work. So that's almost a consequence of the lack of the work programmes. Some elements of the service had been flagged up in a recent health and safety review carried out by the council's health and safety officer, and we were just flagging up a number of areas which needed to progress from the action plan from that, and then again some issues around the procurement of a number of contracts, including for the maintenance of vehicles that needed some attention to ensure compliance with the procurement regulations, and then finally some arrangements around the costing of external works that they carry out that we didn't feel was robust and sufficiently evident. So that those are the areas that we have flagged up in those two audits. I'd say it is pleasing that the rest of the work that we did in the year, we were able to give substantial assurance on those other areas. And then just going down the page to page 8, there's two follow-ups that I will draw to members' attention out of the previous Steve, and that is change control and IT third-party supplier management and external data sharing. So these were two audits that we had reviewed a while back, and these were the follow-ups on it. They had been given limited assurance when they were first issued. It's pleasing to note that some progress had been made, and we were able to revise that assurance to partial. But likewise, we weren't able to give them substantial assurance, so they still had some areas to progress. For the change management, this was around getting the change management policy approved. It has been drafted and was in the process of going through, but hadn't yet been approved. And secondly, for the third party supplier management, there was a need to produce a full list of IT contracts that were in place when they're due to expire to enable re-tendering, and to have that awareness of what we've got in place, and that still hadn't been done at the time of the follow-up. As I say, pleasing to note the third one, the garden waste, had moved from partial to substantial, so we were happy to report that to committee. As I say, that draws to a close the presentation report to committee for the work last year. So I will go over onto the annual report for 22-23. So it is a detailed report that sets out how we've carried out the work and some of the background on the first few pages about the requirements for internal audit and things like that. The first thing I will draw to members' attention is on page 12 of the agenda, page 3 of the actual annual report, and that is at the top of the page where we talk about the review of internal audit. So every year we have a requirement to do a self-assessment to ensure we're compliant and to give the committee assurance that we are an effective function, and we also have to do an external review done by an independent party, and we were fortunate to have had that done in the autumn of 2022. The results of that external review have previously been reported to the committee. So taking into account that external review and my internal assessment at the end of the year, I'm comfortable that we were substantially compliant with the standards. They use this strange term that we haven't got any significant non-conformance issues rather than compliance. But we were able to say that. The one area that is flagged up every year is around organisational independence, and that's because these standards are global, written by the Institute of Internal Auditors for numerous bodies, not just the public sector, and their expectation is that to maintain the independence, the Chief Audit Executive, or in my case the Chief Internal Auditor role, should report to the board and not to an officer of the organisation. In local government, this isn't the done thing. And specifically, they say that the audit committee should be responsible for the pay and remuneration of the chief internal auditor, which would be quite nice if I could get you to set my pay, as long as you were generous. But as I say, in local government, it doesn't work that way. We have quite a strict and regimented regime for pay of officers that I am part of, and that goes through job evaluation and everything else. So we do have to report that as a non-conformance issue, but it's not significant. We have got sufficient other controls to maintain the independence. But as I say, the standards require us to report that to you. Probably the next thing I'll draw to members' attention about is just to talk about the quality of the work that we do and the satisfaction of managers. That's over on page 13. There's a table about a third of the way down. We did a survey of managers, and generally for each of the questions that we asked, we got an average of 4.2 out of 5 for their satisfaction score, which I am happy with. It shows that generally we're meeting the approval of the managers. As an auditor, I suppose I probably wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't upset one or two managers on occasions who didn't always agree with what we're saying. So I can live with not getting full scores there. But
could we ask what was last year's score?
You can ask. I say, unfortunately, we haven't done a similar review for a number of years, and the last time we did one, it was on different questions. So we haven't got anything to compare it to, unfortunately. My intention is I will probably run it again with the same questions at the end of this year, just to see what it is. I will say I've shared the full results with Judith. The one, there was a couple of areas where we did have a lower score, but that does correlate to a particular audit that we did where we didn't give them a very high assurance. And I'm not saying the two things are connected, but I'll leave that to the committee to judge. Moving down to the bottom of the page, I then start talking about the annual opinion and how that links into the annual governance statement. And then I do set out in the box at 2.9 on page 14 the actual opinion. And I think from the work that we've done in the year, I'm happy to give partial assurance that the council's governance arrangements are adequate and operating effectively. So that's not to say there are major, major issues, but I'm also not saying that everything is okay. There are a number of areas where we see reoccurring issues. We gave two audits limited assurance, and we gave a number of audits partial assurance as well throughout the year. So that is reflective, I think. That opinion is justified.
Excuse me, I know I'm new here.
Yeah.
And ask a question. Should we be worried though that it's partial?
I think I wouldn't say worried. I would be saying that you should be alert to a number of things that you should be looking out for, and it probably feeds into the last item on the agenda, the annual governance statement. So the areas where I'm saying that I'm reluctant to give full assurance, have they been addressed, or management's leadership team putting appropriate actions in place to try and deal with those areas? I'm trying to think back. I don't think I've given higher than partial assurance for a significant time in terms of what we do. So it probably is our cautious nature as internal auditors, but also it is flagging up that there are some areas where we probably do need to do some more work as an organisation. I think just feeding on from that, if you go over the page to page 15, right, over a couple of pages to page 15, where I start setting out those significant issues that we've identified in the year. So that table at the top of the page just gives you a list of audits we've done and their assurance levels. And then talks about the follow-ups that we've also done. And as you can see there, it is slightly concerning that only 57% of recommendations have been implemented at follow-up. So there is, even where we are identifying weaknesses and controls that need improving, there is slow progress happening. Now, the managers have got a lot of other things on their plate, and there are some resource implications as well in a number of areas, and staffing issues in there. So some of that may be reflective of those things as well. But I think really what I'd draw members' attention to is paragraph 3.7 that starts on page 15 and goes over to page 16. And those are the specific areas where I have some concerns that we've had these issues identified on a recurring basis over a number of years, over a number of audits, and it's worth drawing to the committee's attention those areas that I think you need to focus on, and when you get the annual the annual governance statement report, I'd be asking you to consider whether you feel those have been appropriately addressed as the chief internal auditor. In terms of that, we then move on to section 4, which talks about the performance of the team. We delivered 91% of the plan against the target of 90%. So essentially I'm saying we have done sufficient work to give you that assurance and to make that opinion valid. And also the opinion is informed by other information that I have from being an officer within the council and within other meetings and other information that I get hold of, like performance reports that go to committees and things like that. And then there's a little bit more detail about the audits that we started and haven't finished, and some of the audits that actually related to the previous year's audit plans as well, because we had had, I think since COVID, we've been playing catch up in terms of delivering some of the audit plans. Pleasing to note is when we go down to page 17, 18, that we haven't had any significant fraud or irregularity investigations, and we haven't had anything significant flagged up in the National Fraud Initiative at the moment for the council. In terms of the one allegation that we did have through the confidential reporting sort of route, it soon, when we did the initial review, it soon showed that that had no real substance and was really more about somebody who had a complaint at the council who wasn't really happy the way that was progressing and was trying an alternative route. I don't think I've got anything else really to pull out for members' attention there in terms of that report. But I'm happy to take any questions, Chair, if there are any, or any specifics.
Yeah. I just say you said it's a contractor there, so you've got some contractors working for you to do the audit.
Yeah, the members who've been on the committee for a while will be aware. We have a vacant post that we've struggled to recruit to for a number of years, and we are backfilling that with some support from a contractor who delivers a number of audits. We also use a contractor to do the technical IT audit work for us, where my in-house team don't have the technical knowledge, the specialist knowledge to talk to IT on a parallel level. I'd like to have an in-house resource for that, but what you tend to find is if you get anybody with those skills, they go out off for the higher paid jobs elsewhere anyway, so we can't afford to train and retain people. In terms of the vacant post, my long-term intention is to use that to fill that internally. A couple of years ago, we took on an apprentice who we are training up. They have finished their apprenticeship now and are getting more on-the-ground experience. And because that's a senior post, when they reach the appropriate time, I'm hoping that we can make that post available to them and possibly start again with another apprentice to build our own staff. As I say, it's not an ideal situation to rely on contractors for the general work as we do, but the market out there is not great to actually fill our senior posts on the salaries that we can offer.
Are you happy with that?
Yeah, I just want to add to it, except it's an individual contractor, isn't it?
It's a firm, so we have different people, but it's, yes.
Yeah,
thank
you. Councillor Loughran.
Hey, thank you. I have a couple of things, but I'm also really hard, so help me share the night. I want to go back then to page 6, please, Stephen.
Yes.
I wonder, you know, about building control and this regular contractor being used. Why are we using an external contractor there? Is it because we're short of staff in building control, or is it just, are we in general as a council using a lot of agency staff? Because this is what a lot of this seems to smack off to me. You know, not only here, but in reading through it, there seems to be a lot of external, you know, we're using contractors. I want to know, why are we using contractors? Is it because we've got no staff? Are we trying to do something about getting staff? Or are we just quite happy to be shelling out money to contractors?
In terms of the wider aspects, I can't comment on the number of contractors across the council. I do know we do have a significant number of agency and contract staff backfilling vacant posts, but I can't comment on how many and exactly where they are. The specifics for building control, the one issue that we picked up here, it was for a specialist contractor. I think they were structural engineers off the top of my head, so it was somebody to do some support work for our in-house team, bringing in expert knowledge that we don't have to that level of detail in the team. So it was an appropriate thing to do, and to have those specialist advisors available to us. I think that the specific issue here was that we hadn't gone out and tested the market. We'd just gone back to the same company on a regular basis over a period of time, and actually we were starting to fall foul of our procurement regulations and the best practice to test the market periodically, where you do have routine suppliers, to just make sure you are still getting value for money and paying an appropriate fee.
I'm also a bit concerned, I've got to say, about the fact that you don't do checks and follow-ups, you know, for quite some time. And there are quite a few reports here that do give me cause for concern, and I feel we're waiting a very long time before you're back to see about the follow-ups. Page 13 is the next one.
If I may answer the question, Chair, in terms of the follow-ups, we set a rough timescale to follow up in 6 months, which is deemed appropriate in most cases to allow managers time to progress those things. We are always mindful of the nature of the recommendations we had and how long those will take to implement. For each action, we set an implementation date, or we agree an implementation date with the relevant manager. So some of those could be done quite quickly. Some things, if it's an annual process that we've picked an issue up with, it's quite often not possible for the managers to take any action until the next time that is done to actually address the situation. So it means that we can't go back to follow those up for sometimes 8, 9, 12 months, depending on when we picked it up.
Yeah.
So we're mindful of what the nature of the recommendation is at times, but we if something was significant and we felt it could be addressed quite quickly, we would probably follow it up quicker than and we wouldn't necessarily wait for the 6 months. That is just a sort of ballpark we use.
If I may carry on then, Chair, because talking about the managers and them having quite a lot of work to do. Page 13, where you mentioned about the review of internal audit, I'm really concerned that, you know, 25 responses were received covering approximately only 50% of managers have actually responded to the questionnaire. I think that's very poor. And I don't know what can be done, you know, to encourage them to fill in questionnaires, you know. Is it because you've got a complicated questionnaire, or is it just they can't be bothered?
Well, I can answer the second part of that quickly. It wasn't a complicated questionnaire. As I say, there were three key questions that we reported to the committee here. There was a few other questions around what type of work we'd done, had we had work in the year. So there were maybe 10 questions in total that we put to them. As obviously the key ones are here. And we made it simple. It was an electronic questionnaire that got emailed out to them. It wasn't complicated to return. So.
Were you quite happy with 50%?
I was pleasantly surprised that we actually got 50%. Oh. Normally,
previously
when we've done questionnaires, we're lucky if we get 30% return rate.
Well, can't the senior management do something about this?
If I can just answer that, I mean, there's probably little we can do in terms of, we could make it compulsory, but I'm not sure that that really would give kind of the quality of the responses that we're looking for. And we are mindful that managers have got a lot going on. So, you know, often these things will fall to the bottom of the priority list. I actually also do consultation engagement in other areas. It's one of the other services I look after. And actually, 50% is an excellent response rate. It really is. You can be as low as sort of anywhere between 10 and 20%. If you're going out to survey the public on things, unless somebody's got a really passionate interest in it, you won't get a response. It is very difficult to do that. So 50% is an excellent response, particularly to an audit survey. But it really is. We can do reminders. Because I don't think I raised the leadership team, so I could perhaps encourage a bit more response there next time. But I'd say 50% isn't a bad response.
higher response rates have cost implications. They take significant amount of time. As someone who, in my day job, I have to push up the response rate for student surveying to 60 and 70%, chasing them costs the university a substantial amount of money. So I think that we should be mindful that pushing higher in terms of response rates will have a cost implication.
I'll just make one other point, then I'll hand over. So I think also, if I look at page 15, 3.5, that two recommendations had no progress at all, and then as you followed them up in 6 months' time, no progress. Well, I guess that would maybe depend on, well, it doesn't really depend on how important it was, because I think it's important that progress is made. Whenever recommendations, if a problem is discovered and a recommendation is made, then I think there ought to be some attempt at making even a tiny bit of progress. You know, I think that 6% to have made no progress is quite a lot.
I mean, as I say, it can sometimes be a technicality in terms of timing when we do the follow-up if they haven't had the opportunity to do it. I say without going through and finding the exact recommendation, I can't say if that is the case in this instance or in those two instances. But it also isn't unusual. It is also a sign that managers aren't addressing some of the things that they could do. And there are, we do come across actions which are either not implemented or partially implemented for a very long time. So, for example, policies, an action is to update a policy or put procedures in place. They start drafting those documents and drafting changes to procedures, but they never get around to implementing them, so we'll follow it up. We may mark that as partial, but when we go back again in 6 months' time, or 12 months time, that's still in the same position and it hasn't progressed. Actually, those can be as indicative of issues as something where nothing has been done, because they've sort of done a little bit of work and then leave it, and they never return to it.
Jerry, if I can just add and try and add some reassurance to that, we have agreed that a slight change in the way, not so much we're going to do the follow-ups, but the way we report them. So actually we're going to start doing some more regular reporting to leadership team. So those sort of issues should then get picked up there and put some extra pressure on that. So hopefully when we come to do this time next year, hopefully we'll see that, you know, to some degree all recommendations are in progress.
Perhaps we could see some more of a timeline on these recommendations and see whether they were stalling a little bit more often, because these are not identified which recommendations have not progressed, and to have 17 that have only been 50%, 57% implemented is not fantastic either.
I mean, in terms of that, it's something that I can look at. As I say, members who've been on the committee before will know that we've recently purchased some software to help us manage that. The way that records the recommendations that we make, I think, will enable us to do some aged analysis in terms of recommendations and outstanding that would have been difficult the way we recorded the follow-ups in currently. So it is something that I can look at in the future.
Well, I think that will be quite useful for the committee to be able to see whether your work is actually being implemented. And that the recommendations that we're talking about here are actually being identified and followed, and how the follow-up's working.
I think as well, we do put more detail in when we do the quarterly progress report, so you'll see a lot more detail in those around the progress made in implementing recommendations. At the end of the day, this is the annual report, it is a summary, so it perhaps isn't helping give you that level of detail, but I say in the quarterly ones, you would get more information. And again, we can have a look at that in terms of the system that has been purchased.
It's just unfortunate that we're seeing that as the first meeting.
Yeah.
And then we've got to sign off the governance statement to say everything's working all right.
Can I have assurance that these points that have been raised on page 6 and 7 are in your follow-up plan?
Yeah, okay. Any audits that we do, any recommendations that we make are logged, and those that are high and medium we do follow up. Okay. So they will be due a follow-up, and members should see those coming through to a future, in a future progress report as a follow-up.
Okay. And my other question is 3.7, what assurance are we going to have that in 12 months' time this list is going to be significantly reduced?
I think I'm going to take the liberty of answering that one, if that's okay, Chair, because this is the list that then feeds into the annual governance statement.
Yeah.
So we will get a progress update on that, and we'll pick up certain parts of it in the audit reports as we go through the year as well. I'll save anything else I want for them until we get to the annual governance statement.
Well, I think we should note as well 4.1. Where the target for 22-23 was 90%, but we actually achieved 91% against the actual for 21-22, which was only 74%. So we can see that quite substantial steps have been taken.
Following on from that, Chair, can I just say, if you look at 4.7, we were seeing that in addition to the audit plan, the section has also carried out a number of other pieces of ad hoc work and consultancy exercises during the year, and these include advice and system charge. Can we really afford to be doing this whenever this is happening? What benefit do we get from doing this?
Couldn't we perhaps have a little bit of clarity? That is internal consultancy.
It is, Chair. It is work that we do within the time that I build into the audit plan. We set aside some time for ad hoc work and consultancy.
Yeah.
And actually, in a lot of ways, the work that we do in that is actually seen as beneficial. So rather than managers waiting for us to come in to carry out an audit of processes they've put in place, what we try and encourage is for them to come to us when they're redesigning systems or building in changes, so that we can make comments up front. And that's what's referred to in that paragraph. It's that type of work where things are changing, people have come to us, ask for advice, and it may be something that takes half an hour to just quickly read through something. It may be something that takes half a day to read on something, some comments. It could be something that takes us 5 days to actually work with them, going through detailed policy documents, process documents, to make sure they're there. But actually, for me as the Chief Internal Auditor, I'd far rather work with somebody to make sure the controls are in place, adequate controls are in place up front, than go in and find weaknesses when we do an audit.
It's really timely, Chair, that the question is asked as we head into a period of change and transformation.
Yeah.
And it's something that I certainly, with my transformation hat on, will be wanting Stephen and the team to input to as we go through all of that review in our processes and we start to make changes. I want to know that they're right up front before we put them into operation. But we will still make sure we get a balance between that work and the regular work of the team as well.
Councillor Loughran, would you like to come back on that?
No. I'll just keep an eye on that, as is my wont.
Fine. Have we finished, Stephen?
If there are more questions, I'm comfortable. Yeah, I think.
Yep.
So it's a recommendation on page 3, Mr. Chairman.
So we have a recommendation that the committee notes the internal audit report.
So noted, Mr. Chairman.
Noted.
Any objections?
Yeah.
Thank you.
So noted.
Thank you.
Which takes us onto item 3B.
Page 25.
Page 25. Internal Audit Charter and Quality Assurance and Improvement Programme.
Okay, that's me again, Chair. I'll take you through this. So these are two key documents for the internal audit function that we're bringing to the committee here. They are both existing documents that we have but have been subject to review and update, partly on the back of the results of the external quality assurance in the review that we had. There were a number of recommendations in that about updating some elements of this, or perhaps putting more emphasis in certain areas and flagging things up. In terms of the first one, the audit charter, that is really the terms of reference for the internal audit section. It sets out our remit, our relationship with the organisation, how we will operate, rights of access and things like that. This was last issued in 2016, and I was criticised in the review for not bringing it back to members before now with updates. I think in my defence, I don't think anything significant has changed since that time, but I will, on the back of the review, I will bring this document to members on a more regular basis. It may be that we don't update it, but it's been recommended that I perhaps need to bring it with the annual report the audit plan on a regular basis, so you've got the terms of reference to the function when you review that plan. I will go through just a few of the key highlights. There isn't a substantial amount of change in the document. There's a number of superficial changes to some of the job titles, as we've been subject to a restructure at the senior management level. Some of those posts have changed. But in terms of the content of the document itself, section two, where it talks about a mandate for internal audit, that's an area that was partly in the charter beforehand. So that's on page 29 of the agenda. That was partly in there, but it wasn't quite so explicit. So what we're talking about in the mandate is our reason for being, that our sort of authority to be here. So it refers back to the legislation and the standards and bits and pieces in there. I'd say the next significant change is at 5.3, which is on page 31. And that's just a bit of narrative around the shared services and the changes and how that may impact on the work of internal audits over there. And then the next significant change is paragraph 7.3 on page 33. And really, this was one of the things that was picked up in the EQA that we had done, and it was the fact that we perhaps didn't give enough prominence to ethics and the Nolan principles in our charter and in the documents that we do. So essentially, this paragraph does bring that to the fore. The ethics is a significant part of the work that we do. We have to comply with not only the ethical standards of the organisation, but the public sector internal audit standards have a whole section on there about ethical standards for internal auditors, so we'll try to reflect that in this paragraph. I think off the top of my head that is there is a couple more significant changes on paragraph 13.9 and 13.12 that have been updated as well. And 13.9 is talking about the audit planning process. So we would traditionally prepare the audit universe, risk all that, and base the audit plan on that aspect. What I've recognised here is what we actually did through COVID, and I've done for a couple of years since then, is where there is a significant change in risk or some extenuating circumstance, that we'll set the audit universe to one side and focus on the significant risks at that time. So during COVID, it was the changes that were happening, the work that we were doing to deal with that pandemic. We've also taken that stance this year with the changes that are happening with shared services and those significant changes that present one-off type risks or one-off impacts on the council. So we are going to focus on those. And then 13.12 is a paragraph in there that just gives us the ability that where we have time and skills to offer external work, that we can do that within reason But that will be flagged up to audit committee and agreed in advance with those, and that's done through the audit plan and through other aspects. So
we did discuss that where you're making a number of significant changes in an important document, it would be nice for the committee to be able to see what was in there before and has been taken out, and which bits are new, as often happens in legal documents where you have an alteration. And it would aid the committee's work when they get these 86 pages to read through to be able to highlight on the bits that they need to pay particular attention to.
I will take that on board, Chair. In terms of major deletions, there is nothing significant that's come out of the document.
Right.
The significant changes are the elements that I've just gone through. As I say, they're not in the detail of the report on the agenda, but I have pulled those for members' attention there. As I say, most of it is around changes in title, changes in that, a little bit of additional emphasis. So there's no significant change in direction or anything else on that charter. But yeah, I will take on board those comments.
Thank you,
Chairman. Just to prove that I've read the document, can I refer you to page 31, please? 5.3, penultimate line. I don't think you mean that. I think you mean to cover both accounts.
Could you tell us a particular point again, please,
Roy?
Okay.
5.3 on page 31.
Yep.
Okay, penultimate line. Wherever possible, audits will aim...
Yeah, apologies, yeah.
That's just to prove that I've read the document.
I won't comment that this document's been through leadership team before it's come to committee.
Oh, no.
Yeah. I will get that updated, Chair.
Coming back to you also to the point that was made there about you're talking about 1512, Stephen, and the fact that you're actually mentioning the audit work that you're doing for Chief District County Leisure Provider, is that now going to be a permanent feature? The fact that you've now got it here in your audit charter, are you now on a permanent basis going to be doing this work for IHL?
As it stands at the moment, for you, Chair, we have not entered into any firm commitments or any long-term arrangements with them. It is being taken on an ad hoc basis. As I say, this will be, I think, is this coming into the second year we've done work?
It is,
for them? Yeah. So it's something that is partly a benefit to the council at Cannock, but to IHL to help them with the situation they're going through at the moment. It's actually not been a significant amount of work that we have put there done for them, and it has brought some returns for the section because it's actually provided the income which we've used to buy our management system, our audit management system and the software. So it's been beneficial in a number of ways at the moment. As I say, if it does become anything that is having an adverse effect on the plan or on particularly the ability to deliver an opinion for either council, we will be flagging that up and we will be reviewing the situation, and it will be something that is carried on to have conversations with Judith and the Section 151 officer as well to make sure that they carry on being comfortable with what we're doing.
I can accept, you know, the principle that where resources allow and the team have the relevant skills, the internal audit section can provide work for other organisations. It was just that you expanded after that that made me think this is now going to be a regular thing. You know, I can't accept that, you know, where you've got the skills, etc., and the time, then yes, you will undertake. But I just wondered, was that going to be a payment feature that it was for IHA?
As I say, to reassure you, at the moment there are no long-term commitments. It is reviewed on an annual basis.
And we continue to bring it to the audit committee as part of the audit plan each year, kind of our arrangement for handling that, because there are different ways of us doing it if we need to. And we certainly don't go out and market our services to anybody else. We're not actively touting for the business.
Not become a profit centre yet, then.
There are a number of local authorities who do that and actually go out and deliver significant amounts of work for others and actually take staff on, and we would never look to do that, to specifically take staff on and to deliver external work.
It does cause conflicts of interest. I've been dealing with one in the education sector where the county had resources which they sold to other counties, to the detriment of needy pupils within their own county at a not much later date. It is something that has to be closely monitored.
So if I may, Chair, that sums up the key elements of the charter that I wanted to bring members' attention to. The other document is the Quality Assurance and Improvement Programme, which is quite a grand title for the document. I'd say it's not something that I chose. It is a requirement of the standards that we have such a document, and they give the title for it. But essentially, this is a document that summarises a number of aspects for the section. So it's about how we, our quality assurance framework for the section, for the work that we do, how we train our staff. And it also covers aspects such as the performance indicators for the team and what we have in place. I did say that this was an existing document. This has been a significant rewrite. I think the previous document was 2, maybe 2.5 pages long. This is substantially longer. Again, based on the results of the EQA, we were encouraged to put more information in here around a number of aspects. So, in terms of telling members anything that's changed significantly, I don't think it's relevant for this one. I think it's best to be read as a whole new document. And as I say, it does pull out a number of key things about how we do the work, how we make sure that work is of an appropriate quality, both on a piece-by-piece basis and before reports are issued, as well as the overall quality of the section in terms of the self-assessment I do and the external review, where the results of those assessments go, and also talking about how we manage the performance of individual members and team and that. And the appendix 1, which is on page 51, actually sets out some of the key performance indicators that we maintain for the team. The first few will be particularly relevant for the committee because they are things that we bring to you, and it will be how you oversee and scrutinise the performance. The second table on there are more internal PIs that I monitor the staff to, so you wouldn't necessarily see the results of those, but it's to enable you to have assurance of the things that we're looking at. And then the final table are just some other information which is useful for the audit committee to have, but are not, they may be performance related, but they're not actually metrics measuring the work of internal audit, they're measuring other things, but we bring them to this committee. So, as I say, I'm not going to draw anything else to members' attention, but I'm quite happy to answer any questions on those that members may have.
So we're being asked to note the updated quality assurance improvement programme.
Yes. The committee is required to approve the charter and note the improvement
updated.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we approve the charter and secondly that we note the contents of the updated quality assurance and improvement programme.
Thank you. Anyone, any objections? So approved and noted.
Thank you.
Do I have to sign in?
No, not at this stage. No, okay, we'll let you off. So item 3C on page 54, Mr. Chairman.
Mm. strategic risk register.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to take that on to Chair. So this report sets out the work that we've done in reviewing the strategic risk register as at the 1st of April. Members will see from the table at 3.1, overall the number of risks has remained the same. However, two of the red risks have now reduced their score and are now down to amber. So that's had the opposite effect then to increase the number of amber risks we've got. The two risk scores that have changed are set out at 5.7. So the first one of those is around the economy of the borough. And that one's changed because actually the economic outlook for the borough's economy is better than we'd originally imagined that it would be at this point. That risk was brought onto the risk register in that format as a result of the COVID pandemic. And so things have moved on both in terms of the kind of position globally and more locally with some of the work that's going on around the town centre transformation, the investment that we're going to see through the UK Shared Prosperity Fund. So it was felt that that risk has reduced. The second one was around the council's key contractors and whether they remain sustainable. And again, this was a risk that came onto the risk register as a result of the pandemic, when there was certainly concerns around the waste contractor and the leisure contractor at the time and the impact that the pandemic was having on their operations. Again, that has largely improved, and the only reason it's probably still sitting around an amber is due to the kind of the impact that the cost of energy and the cost of living is having on those two key contractors. But we continue to keep an eye on that one, and I'd like to think that that we'll see that one come down to green at some point in the not too distant future. So they're the key changes in terms of the risk register. Appendix 1 summarises kind of on the page all the strategic risks that we're keeping a watching brief over, the scores and the direction of travel on those scores, and then Appendix 2 behind it gives you a summary for each of those risks in terms of the progress that's been made since the last review. The more detailed risk register is held independently, so that's a summary of all the work that's gone on and the latest position for all of those risks. And that's all I wanted to say on the report, Chair, but I'll happily do my best to answer any questions.
Has anyone got any questions?
Why is HS2 a risk?
From memory, it was more around the impact that it would have on the borough and its residents, particularly in terms of the environmental impact, and keeping a watching brief on that.
Yes, it is. It's about that. It's about how we're managing the work that's going on. The council's got a number of regulatory functions in terms of planning and noise monitoring and that type of thing that we have to do. So it was about recognising that and dealing with it, because it was bringing in significant work in peaks and troughs to certain teams, but also ensuring the quality of life for the residents, that the work wasn't adversely impacting them. So yeah, it's not a risk of terms of HS2, it's a risk of the impact of the work that's going on.
Chairman, could I ask on page 60 about how the garden community at Mesa Brook, because how is that progressing?
Chair, I wouldn't actually have the details for that.
It's probably the wrong place to ask the question. Because we're looking at process here rather than achievement.
I know, but if they know then, surely they can tell us. If they're mentioning it here.
Yeah.
Chair, we can only comment on kind of the narrative that we can provide in terms of the management of the risk around the project. The scrutiny committee would probably be the best place to ask for an update in terms of whether that is in terms of the actual delivery of the project. It will be referenced in the performance report. I know there's an update in the performance report that will be going through to the scrutiny committee in a matter of weeks.
So a good question, Councillor, but perhaps the wrong place.
Chairman, be able to ask it then.
Cabinet.
All the scrutiny.
Questions in Cabinet.
there is a performance update going to the scrutiny committee, but you could ask the question there and then it could be referred back to the Cabinet if required.
Okay. Can I ask them then, Chair, on page 61, what is CIC? The Council has supported a local CIC.
It's a community interest company. So they are sort of almost voluntary bodies is set up as a company to deliver charitable aspects and things like that.
So are they distributing that to several food banks then?
I believe that what they're referring to here is an organisation that's set up to distribute as a hub. So from memory, it's what was set up for COVID in terms of food distribution. It's then been moved over to another body who's taken it on. So it's the residual elements of the council role in food distribution that we had during COVID that's now been taken on by the voluntary sector to perpetuate it.
You might like to ask Councillor Fern. No, it's not that process.
Has Councillor Fern got any comments he wishes to?
No, we're only here to focus on process.
So we continue to focus on process then, and we gather that it has been passed over, the responsibility for it. And we'll find somewhere else to ask the question of how successful that's been. Any other questions, councillors?
Well, just look at the agendas for other places where they can get answered then.
Well, it's a valid comment, but as we made the point at the start, and as you know quite well, Councillor Loughran, we concentrate on process rather than council achieving its objectives.
Mr. Chairman, can I move that we note the draft strategic risk register?
You can.
Seconded.
Have we any objections?
Thank you.
So noted.
Thank you. So we've got 3D on 67.
3D on 67 is our last item on the agenda. Annual governance statement. A summary of everything we're doing then, Judith, please.
Yes, Chair. I won't spend too long on the covering report. What I will deal with first, though, is paragraph 3.5, which is actually a progress update on the annual government statement from 21-22. So there were 9 items that were raised in the previous statement. 6 of those actions have been completed or are on target to be completed. 1 is in progress. Work hasn't commenced on 1, and then another 1 wasn't actually due to be commenced. The 1 item that hasn't seen any progress is the information governance framework, and I'll touch on that because I think that has been included in this year's annual governance statement as well. Any of the items that haven't been completed, as a matter of routine, would normally be carried forward. However, we've had a bit of a review this year around the whole remit of the annual governance statement, and we've taken it back to its more basic context that it is around our governance framework. So there are just a couple of things that won't be carried forward. They're items from the strategic risk register, and they will continue to be managed through that process. So they're not being lost, they'll just be continuing to be managed through a different channel. So if I turn to the annual governance statement for this year, I take a little bit of context around that. As I've just mentioned, we've actually kind of taken a step back in reviewing our governance framework this year, looked at it partly through the benefit of having a new pair of eyes with our new Deputy Chief Executive for resources and kind of his thoughts and observations over the last 6 months. And I say we take it back to a more fundamental level. I wouldn't want any members to think that the list that's now included in there means that everything's wrong. It isn't. It's a recognition that certain key components of the governance framework haven't been reviewed for a number of years. So one, we want to go back and do that work, make sure everything's current and up to date. We want to make sure that we've got really solid foundations, particularly as we move forward through some transformation processes. It's important to have really solid foundations there. They also, as well, the issues that we picked out do reflect the work that Stephen has raised as part of the annual audit report as well. So if I take you through briefly through the kind of the annual governance statement itself, it sets out at section 3 that we have a framework, what those key principles are, and then at section 4 it sets out the review process that we go through. And there are a number of elements to that. The main ones that we use are the work of the internal audit team through the annual audit report, through the work of the scrutiny committee, the cabinet. I look at the work from the strategic risk register. I also look at the work that this committee has done through the year and the work of our external auditors. I also talk to leadership team, and more particularly this year we focus more around statutory officers. I say particularly with having a new deputy chief exec 151 officer, it's been really helpful to kind of stand back from things and get their thoughts on where we're at. So that kind of builds up then to this opinion, and again we've got quite a I suppose a risk averse opinion, in as much as we're saying that everything's generally okay, but there are still things that we could do better. And then we've set out at section 6 what those key issues are that we believe that we need to pick up and work on. So the first noticeable thing on that list, at 6.1, is to actually review and update the Code of Governance. That hasn't been reviewed since I think it's about 2016. I've already commenced some of the work on that. So we'll be aiming to bring that by the committee later this year. The point below that lists some really key elements of our governance framework that we're planning on reviewing over the next 2 years, because it's a big commitment to do all of that. So over the next couple of years, they're the key aspects that we want to review and bring up to date and make sure are working effectively for the council. And some of those do touch on the things that are in the annual audit report, particularly around procurement and project management and performance reporting. The ones that follow then are the items that we've carried forward from last year. So some of those, not just because they haven't been tackled, but because they're actually ongoing issues. That first one in terms of financial stability, that does still feature on our strategic risk register. It is a fundamental part of our governance and concerns as we go forward. So there's some key actions setting out in there around budget setting for the coming year. Similarly with the officer capacity, that has been an ongoing issue for a few years, and as we move through the shared services, the longer term aim is that that will help to address some of those issues, and we're already making progress. We've made the first step on that journey with the senior management team restructure, but there's still work to be done and there are still challenges we face with that. The next one, I've touched on it a couple of times now in terms of shared services, big piece of work to be done around transformation, and it's important that we get the governance around that right. So we have set in place some key member boards to oversee that, and an officer group that's overseeing the delivery of the project plan. So hopefully that will give assurance to how that work's going. Cyber security remains on it. It is an ongoing risk. There was a particular piece of work that was due to be completed last year that we've started, and we haven't quite finished it. We will do that. But actually what we want to do moving forward is to formalise everything that we do into a security strategy. And actually we can then give better assurance to the committee how effective that strategy is working at managing the risk of cyber attacks. And we're also looking at some further options that we could do to improve that framework. But they come at a cost, so there will be some decisions to be made whether we actually take any further enhancements or whether what we have is sufficient. The finance system has been a feature in the annual government statement for the last couple of years, ever since we purchased a new one, and it's fair to say we have had a number of issues. The majority of those have now been addressed, and the accounts for 22-23 are in the process of being closed on the new system. The key issues that now remain are developing the reporting side of it and user training, and they're set to be done in this coming year. The employees' code of conduct was flagged last year, but we weren't planning to redress that one until 23-24, and that actually could have sat that with that wider review of the governance framework, because that is a key part of that. And the last item on there is the one that hadn't progressed in 22-23, and that one's being carried forward, and that's the information governance framework. And I'd have to put my hand up and confess to being the person that's acted in effect as the block on that. The work has been done by the information manager. The draft is there, I just haven't had the capacity and the time to review that, but I'll pick that up with the head of law and governance, who will be now assuming responsibility for that service, and we'll make sure that that one moves forward this year. So Chair, that sets out all the significant governance issues that we consider should be included in the annual government statement for this year, and it's whether the committee feels as though that is an accurate representation for the information of 39 of those answers that have been over the last year.
Just a general comment on that, Judith, it's a big piece of work.
It's a very big piece of work. I say the bulk of it we are saying will have to be split over 2 years because there is such a lot there to do. Some of them, there are other reasons why we need to do them. Procurement regulations, there's going to be a change in the legislation. We're just waiting for that to come through. So we're going to have to rewrite those regardless. And we will give the priority to those sort of pieces of work.
Are you happy that we have the capacity to do it?
I'm hoping so, yes.
Sorry, that was a yes.
Well, I'll continue to keep you updated through the progress report.
We are being asked to sign this off, you know.
Yes.
Sorry.
In section 6.1, it talks about the governance framework and identifies, in particular, reviewing and updating, for example, the procurement regulations. In the annual audit report, we've noted, it says actually that there's a problem with compliance and awareness. Compliance and awareness aren't words that I'm seeing in here. Is there a program around compliance and awareness? Obviously, there's the audit process which helps with compliance, but awareness is a bigger problem.
Yeah. So what we'll do, once we've rewritten the procurement regulations, we're going to roll out some training, and hopefully that will help to raise the awareness of the compliance. And we're also going to take a slightly different approach on certain aspects of compliance that have been flagged, particularly around the use of procurement waivers. Both myself, the monitoring officer, and the section 151 officer have raised concerns, and we are flagging it with relevant officers. It's just, we almost need a bit of a pause because we're in a bit of a cycle of needing to do things, and we just need to take a bit of time out so we can put some of these things right. So, but no, we will be doing all of those. I apologise for skipping over that part.
Are you happy with?
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Information governance.
So it's the term we use that encompasses kind of the data protection for freedom of information and all aspects of data management, really. So the overarching framework will set the direction, but then below it we've got all the documents as well. So we'll have like a data retention policy and a data management policy. We've got a data protection policy. So it's not quite as bad as it sounds in the fact that we don't have that bit because we've got the individual components. What we wanted to do was put this other document across the top that makes sure that nothing falls through the gaps and that everything kind of ties in together, really.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just going to sort of say that there's one hell of a lot of work here. I'm pleased that you're happy that you have the capacity to complete all of this, and I look forward to seeing next year's AGS and showing what progress has actually been made. On that basis, I would like to suggest that we approve the annual government statement and ask the chairman to sign it up. But I just look to the previous chair and ask her if I was going to do that. You were going to sign it up, wouldn't you?
Yes, that's a yes.
That's a yes as well.
But don't be persuaded by what I would do. That has nothing to do with me now.
Councillor Loughran, I was always impressed by the way that you handled the committee. And I thought we got through some considerable amount of work.
£10,000 there. So I think we should approve the AGM.
Okay. Any seconder?
I'll second that.
Thank you, Councillor Loughran.
Thank you.
Okay, Karen.
Thank you. That was the last item.
That was the last item on the agenda. Thank you very much for your diligence in working your way through all of that, and we've even without the air conditioning, we've managed to keep going to 7:45. Thank you.